Good evening and a very happy Thanksgiving to you and yours, hoping that you're able to enjoy time with family and or friends. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. If it's Thursday, 6 p.m., it is Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org. I'm your host, John Pierce. Our engineer this evening is Neil Heaver. And my guest is Dr. Dustin Nash from the Religion Studies Department at Muhlenberg College. We are going to be talking a lot about the Bible this evening. And maybe even, Dustin, talking about Bibles.
Most likely. If I'm talking about it, it's probably going to be Bibles.
We're going to ask right away, which Bible are we talking about, right? So Dr. Nash hails originally from Rockford, Iowa. Ooh, a good old Midwesterner in the studio this evening. Received his Bachelor of Arts from Luther College, and following graduation moved to Israel and studied as a visiting graduate student at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, with emphasis on the study of ancient Israelite history and archaeology, as well as biblical studies. Wow, that sounds very esoteric to me.
Huh? I'd say most of the things I study sound esoteric to most people.
Right. But I contend that by my saying esoteric, that says more about me than it does about the topic.
Yes.
Is that true?
That would be true.
There you go. Now, Dr. Nash, on his return to the United States, attended Harvard Divinity School to continue his study of biblical and ancient Near Eastern studies, but with additional work in modern Hebrew literature. So modern Hebrew literature meaning not religiously oriented.
No, not religiously oriented, just modern literature written in Israel since 1948 and earlier.
Some early novels, short stories, poems.
Novels, short stories, especially short stories. I got very interested in the short stories of Edgar Carret. He's a personal favorite.
And after receiving your Master of Theological Studies from Harvard, you entered and completed a master's and PhD in Near Eastern Studies at Cornell University, focusing on the Hebrew Bible and ancient Near Eastern languages and literatures. Since 2014, Dr. Nash has been a member of the Religion Studies Department at Muhlenberg College, where he teaches a variety of courses in religion and Jewish studies, such as Jewish traditions, myth, religion, and creation, Paths in Jewish Thought, Introduction to the Hebrew Bible, and Speaking with the Divine, Divination, Shamanism, and Prophecy. Is that the right pronunciation?
Shamanism.
Shamanism. Speaking with the Divine. How dare you tell us that you're able to speak with the Divine?
Say, I don't make judgments about whether anybody that we study in the class is actually speaking with the Divine.
And I can tell you from experience that Dr. Nash is a very relaxed professor and takes on all questions and is very reasonable, even when at times the students are not so reasonable. But you keep your cool.
I do my best.
Yeah, you do. As a scholar, Dr. Nash's work examines the connection among religion, politics, and memory in the formation of ancient and contemporary identities. Mm-hmm. This theoretic focus has led to publications and public presentations that span from studies of the compositional history of the Hebrew Bible to examinations of the representation of Jews and dinosaurs at the Creation Museum in Petersburg, Kentucky. Well, let me tell you, Dustin, one place that I didn't think we would mention in our chat about the Bible and its relevance is Kentucky.
Yes.
But you were there and visited two museums.
Yes.
Tell us about that. Why would you go to Kentucky?
Well, that's where the Creation Museum is. So I have to say, in the past three years, I've visited Kentucky more than I thought I would in my life. Nothing wrong with Kentucky. A wonderful place, wonderful people.
Beautiful state, too.
But didn't have a reason to go before I started this research with on the Creation Museum. It was originally designed, I went because of a grant for the development of a course at Muhlenberg College. But once I was there and in the space, questions just kept bombarding me. And I thought, well, I'm stuck now. I have to write about this.
All right. So what kinds of questions came into your mind?
My initial question that I usually tell people, what I immediately ask myself on going to the Creation Museum is, what's with all the dinosaurs? That there's a strong emphasis on dinosaurs. Dinosaurs and museums go hand in hand, so that's not necessarily interesting. But this is a museum on the Bible. And most people, when questioned of how many dinosaurs are there in the Bible, would probably say none.
Correct.
And yet you go to the Creation Museum and you can't throw a stone without hitting a dinosaur or a fossil or some sort of representation of of dinosaurs. So I just found that really interesting. I was very into dinosaurs when I was a child. So I often say that project, when it comes to the representation of dinosaurs and Jews, gets to, or it allows me to do all of my favorite things. So I'm a nerd of Judaism, and I'm a nerd of dinosaurs, so this is the ultimate.
All right, I didn't know about the dinosaurs
yes.
part. Yes, I find that children of kindergarten, first grade, and that kind of age, just fascinated by dinosaurs.
Yes.
I guess it's one of the first animals that the teachers teach to the children. Mm-hmm. They're inaccessible to us now. Mm-hmm. We see pictures of them. We try to imagine what they were like, mm-hmm. which is what history is all about.
Yeah.
That's what's the fascinating thing to me about thinking about topics that you study, particularly the Bible, and that is to try to imagine what would life have been like mm-hmm. to live in past times mm-hmm. like that. Now, I said at the beginning of the program that we were going to define the Bible. So how mm-hmm. do you define Bible or Bibles?
Well, in my classes, and even for my own research, I put a strong emphasis on the role of interpretation in how people think about and understand this thing that we call the Bible, and that what one group may call the Bible within that group may not be the same thing to another group. And that's easiest to see when we compare lists of the actual books that are contained in different groups' Bibles. So even if we compare a Protestant Christian Bible with the Old Testament and New Testament to a Catholic Bible, there are books within the Roman Catholic canon that are not within the Protestant canon. And then if we go further and compare even the Protestant biblical canon of the Old Testament to the Tanakh or the Hebrew Bible within Judaism as it's used today, we'll notice that all the books are in a different order. They're in different places. And as I always say, that organization is always argument. There's a reason the books are organized in these different ways in these different communities. And it depends on, or it's related to how they use those texts and how they interpret or make meaning out of those texts. So throwing a word around like the Bible, we should be defining what we mean. One group's Bible saying, well, you know, Jesus in the Bible. Well, that might not be the Bible to somebody else. Jesus isn't in other people's Bible. So that's when I say Bibles, that's usually what I'm getting at.
Right. And the three main groups that you're talking about are within Christianity, Protestantism, Roman Catholicism, and then Judaism, mm-hmm. meaning that now are all the books in what we think of as the Hebrew Scriptures, mm-hmm. all of the exactly the same books are in the Jewish Bible as the Christian Bible?
It depends on which Christian Bible.
Okay.
So as I just said, there's differences between the Protestant canon versus the Catholic canon
right.
versus the Orthodox canon, and then we could expand out even further into historical communities. But
they're the same books, but in different order, except
books,
for the first five, right?
The first five is consistent throughout. So that's and that likely says something about the early authoritative status of those first five books, Torah in the Jewish canon and or Pentateuch in the Christian canon. the differing orders in the different canons, we can see at from a historical standpoint, the way that the different communities use them. With the Protestant canon, there was a return in the translation process to go back to the Hebrew original. And so there is a closer sharing of those texts historically between the Protestant Old Testament canon and the Jewish Hebrew canon, whereas historically the Catholic canon was drawn out of the Latin tradition with a stronger influence from, I think it's the Greek. We're getting outside of my primary research, but are they the same books? Well, it depends on how you read them. Since most Christians in the United States today would be accessing those books in English, primarily, but translations are always interpretations. So languages are not math equations. When you render the text into English, you're making choices about what the text means. That's regardless of any language that you're taking one language into another. That's why translation is as much an art as it is science.
Absolutely. And the more flowery that you get, for instance, poetry, the more difficult.
Yes, absolutely.
So we had an experience as Peace Corps volunteers of dealing with translation of the Cid, classical Cervantes, Don Quixote, and so on. And there was a professor who was Latin American, and he said, well, you know, this, you just can't get across exactly the same thing with the English translation of this. Mm-hmm. And he made the statement, he said, and Shakespeare en español es ridículo. There you go. Translation is so tricky. But you have done translations, correct?
Yes, I have.
From which to which language?
Well, I work in a variety of languages, including, I even have out there floating around a translation of a modern Hebrew short story that I did.
Into English?
Into English.
Okay.
But I work in a lot of languages, and that requires me to translate them in a lot of cases. But so I work in Akkadian and sometimes a little bit of Sumerian, lots of Hebrew, biblical Hebrew, Mishnaic Hebrew, modern Hebrew even, Aramaic, Greek.
Now, when I say translate, I'm talking about a text that you would prepare for the public to read, mm-hmm. as opposed to your own studies.
Yeah. Well, in my own research, I will be translating, especially Hebrew. Hebrew is my primary research language. But because of the way that I, or the disciplinary perspective that I have within biblical studies, whenever I'm translating the text, I'm always looking at other languages. I'm looking at the literatures of other cultures surrounding the Hebrew Bible. So if I'm translating a biblical passage in Hebrew, or if I'm suggesting that our understanding of a biblical passage is different than it has traditionally been translated, then I'm usually have one eye on the Hebrew and one eye on Akkadian and Greek, or later translations of the biblical text in Aramaic or Syriac, which is a dialect of Aramaic. So it's always a multilinguistic endeavor.
Yes, indeed. My guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse is Dr. Dustin Nash, who teaches in the Religion Studies Department at Muhlenberg College. I know that at Lehigh University, they also have the title of Religion Studies, and perhaps at some other colleges, and I'm not familiar with, it used to be at Muhlenberg just plain religion department.
Mm-hmm.
So what's your take on that?
You know, I actually came for my first interview at Muhlenberg College, and the first question that I asked at the restaurant was, why religion studies? It was not the name of a department that I had ever heard of. And actually, outside of Muhlenberg and Lehigh University, I have never seen another department of religion studies.
Oh.
The explanation that was given to me, and you can talk to my other colleagues, they'll know better than I know the history, but that the title was taken over from Lehigh University, that influenced the taking of it. But they also very much wanted to communicate there was a change in the nature of what the department was going to be at a certain point. And they wanted to communicate that change, that that we weren't making a statement about what religion is, that this was more of a analytical and comparative, less theologically oriented type of department, and something that maybe communicated a little bit more of the anthropological side of the study of religion. And so they settled on religion studies as a way of communicating that difference,
that's
or
change. A very, very general way of saying it, as opposed to, I'm just thinking right now as you're speaking, of comparative religions. Mm-hmm. Would that be just a single course that someone might teach? Or how about that as the title for the department?
I don't know what the discussions were at the time. It used to be that there were departments of comparative religion, and some people would still describe a lot of what we do in the department as comparative religion. As a title, it's gone out of fashion, per se. But I was, in my own training, I was trained in comparative religion. That was how it was described,
so what I was doing. You took courses that were called
comparative religion, yes.
And a comparative religion, how many religions would they put into a course like that?
It depended on what the course was. The whole goal of the enterprise is that by bringing things into comparison, you gain a better understanding of both. So when you study Christianity in comparison with different Hindu traditions, you learn something about those particular Hindu traditions and Christianity by noticing what's similar, but also what's different, and that it's a methodology more than anything else. In the past, though, you would have a comparative religion class would be a broad survey of world religions. That's another phrase that's been out there for a long time. And what those were, and then you might get a little, just dip your toe into each tradition. Those kinds of survey courses are incredibly hard to teach when you're an expert in one of them, that you don't want to reduce things down to, you don't want to oversimplify things for the students, that you run the risk of lying to them about them.
And oh my goodness.
But also because when you group things in those categories, you're making statements about what constitutes a religion worth studying and what doesn't constitute a religion worth studying. And that raises some real warning flags, or should raise some real warning flags for us when we start making value judgments in that way. You define what is important by putting it on the syllabus. And if it's not important, then it's not on the syllabus. Well, is that really the case, or you just don't have the time to get to all of those things in a semester? It's usually that you don't have enough time to get to all those
time
things.
Time tends to be an enemy. Yeah. Yes.
But even if that is the cause, that the choice is there nevertheless. And so that can be a problem. I think there's, in general, so we don't teach a broad world religions class in the religion department, and it's gone out of fashion in a lot of places. They're still out there, and they're good. But we've moved more towards looking at elements in comparison of a lot of different religions, and then courses that focus on specific religious traditions within which there's always a great deal of diversity in and of itself. So less a comparison of entire systems to more a comparison of facets. So,
facets of yeah. religions. We are ready to take our first break here on Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm John Pierce, your host. So glad to have you with us on this Thanksgiving evening. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100, extension 6, or WDIY.org.
When I asked Dr. Dustin Nash, who is my guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse, for a topic, he proposed the Bible in the past and the present. So I think it's interesting to think about, many people look upon the Bible as a kind of a history book, but something that should be applicable to our lives today. Mm-hmm. So moral teachings. Mm-hmm. How would you classify the Bible in the past and the present in that way?
It's just a matter of perspective. So absolutely, the way that modern users of the Bible would tend to look at it is as a guidebook, something for with moral lessons, something to teach in the present, something that, though written deep in the past, is continually speaking, or that needs to be interpreted in a particular way, that there's hidden messages in it that might not be on the surface, so deeper meanings, things of that nature. And actually, those ways of approaching the text have deep history as well. We can see already in what we call the Second Temple period, so the period of the Second Temple in Jerusalem from 516 BCE to 70 CE or AD, that those during that time period, people were already starting to read these texts in that way. What I think is a really interesting question is why? Why did they start reading these texts in that way? It's not a, I should say, a natural or organic option. The texts don't tell you to read them in that way.
All right, when you say that way.
To read them as as moral lessons within the stories, as that though they are written about or present kind of past events, that what they're really speaking to you is now in the present. That's not a, as I say, a natural or organic way of reading a text. That we don't do that with other texts. We wouldn't do that with, say, pick any text that you want from the ancient world that wasn't regarded as being sacred. But sacredness and authority, these are things that develop over time as communities approach and use a text in a particular way. But all of those ways of reading the text started very, very early in one sense, or late from a different perspective. Because if we go even further back in time, there's pretty good evidence that communities were not reading those books in that way, that this was a choice or something that developed at a, say, less a choice, but something that developed over a period of time based on a set of particular circumstances and particular contexts, that reading the text in that way allowed them to maintain relevancy even as the original context of their writing changed or were no longer relevant. So when I say in the past and the present, I find particularly interesting how the texts may have originally developed and what they may have how they may have been read in their original context, which isn't necessarily the same way that we would read them today.
Exactly, because all readers bring something to the text mm-hmm. as we read, and so our background plays a big role in how we see that text.
Exactly.
It's constantly evolving.
It is. It's constantly evolving, constantly changing. One of the, say, if there is kind of a theme running through, especially my research and writing on the Bible, it's that things that we tend to take for granted in the present on the meaning of words or the significance of passages isn't necessarily how those words were understood or thought of as important in previous periods. If we go back to the Israelite period or the first temple period, that even at the most basic level of language, that how we understand some words, again, translation is always interpretation, might be different. And that usually there's a lot of good evidence for some of those cases. And that's where looking at these other cultures, looking at Mesopotamia, looking at ancient Egypt, looking at Canaan and all of these other peoples that lived in the world out of which the Hebrew Bible grew can shed some incredible light upon how ancient Israelites may have been thinking about these texts in a way that later communities, whether Jewish or Christian, didn't read them because they were no longer relevant to them. That context had changed and left.
Yes, you mentioned the word context, which is one of your key words, I think, in all of your studies and your teaching.
Yes.
Context is so important.
Yeah.
So I have a simple example that I use for that. Mm-hmm. We make a little dot on a piece of paper mm-hmm. or on the computer screen, and if it's a number, we call it a point, so mm-hmm. 66.2. Mm-hmm. If it's the end of a sentence, then we call it a period. Mm-hmm. And when do we call it a dot? .com.
Yeah.
.org. Huh? By the way, dear listeners, WDIY.org. So it's the same. It's exactly the same symbol on the sheet of paper or the computer screen, mm-hmm. but it's called different things according to the context.
Yes. And actually, if we broaden our view out a bit larger and just think about language in general, that words as they exist within languages or symbols tend to be polyvalent. It's part of the productivity of language, that the same symbol or the same word can have significantly different meanings in different contexts is a fairly common feature of language in general.
Yeah, we can think of how many examples in English where mm-hmm. a certain word, according to the context, so you always have to be keyed into the context. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about something that I know is near and dear to your heart, and that is the whole idea of myth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, once upon a time, a pastor at a church here in the Lehigh Valley talked about the myth of Adam and Eve. Mm-hmm. And then I approached somebody and told this person, you know, that the pastor said that that was a myth. And many times we think that means, well, it wasn't true.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the relationship of myth to the Bible?
This is the whole issue of myth and myth in the Bible. It is. It's this this question or this issue or controversial kind of language. I'm very guilty of being intentionally controversial when I want to be.
Right.
In this case, I don't think it's actually that controversial. It just has to do with how we define what myth is. As a graduate student, I got very interested in just the history of the study of myth, because the history of the study of myth is very closely wrapped up in the history of the academic study of religion. So from a very early period, to study an ancient people's religion was to study their myths, their stories. And that also became incredibly problematic, that as research became more nuanced, as more evidence was found, as greater attention was paid to other elements of cultures and not just the kind of elite written products of the societies, then it became fairly clear that, no, myths aren't equal to religion. They can play a very important role within religions, but they are not the same thing.
But what you're using the word myth just mm-hmm. to mean story.
Yes, important story.
Important story.
Yeah. Most of the problems with defining the word myth get wrapped up in trying to define what the contents of a myth are. And this has been the historical problem with the study of myth. Most people use the word myth, and we all tend to agree on what it means, but then when we try and really define what it means, that's where the problems start. And to come up with a definition that would be applicable in all of the pieces of data that we have is very hard. So if we set aside content, because content can vary widely between different cultures, different cultures' stories can have very, very different elements within them, and yet we can all tend to agree about what we think a myth is versus what we don't think a myth is, then there must be something that's grouping them together in a category. I find persuasive the argument that what's grouping them together is not what is the elements of the plot per se, but more the function of the story, that what it is that the story does. And if we think about myths in this more general character, it opens up avenues for analysis. It also raises issues, because when you broaden things out, that starts to there's a point at which you can make a category so broad that it's no longer useful or mm-hmm. helpful. Right. So that's a danger. But I think there's a lot to this idea that myths are stories that are important within a society and are told in such a way that allow that importance to be communicated with others. It's a particular researcher's definition, or Bruce Lincoln, a famous scholar of myth. His definition of myth is ideology in narrative form. So what I find really interesting is what most people think that ideology is within a story is not usually the actual point of the story. So where you find the function or the meaning or the importance of the story may not be within the literal narrative, but within the larger kind of hierarchies and structures that the story constructs. The point that something that I point out to all of my students in my courses on myth is the way that these stories can survive, even in those cases where science has provided an explanation for what it seems like the story is interested in explaining. So with my course on creation stories, the big one is, where does the world come from? Where does the cosmos come from? And students get very wrapped up in that these stories need to be understood as literal explanations of where the world comes from. But we can see by comparing cultures and through time that even within societies where the literal interpretation has been challenged, that the stories remain and the stories continue to be told and continue to be used. Question is, why then? It can't be that the purpose of the story was, or the sole purpose of the story was to explain. What the story is explaining isn't what we initially thought was important about the story. I think that lens, taking that onto the Bible, is very productive. That it helps us get away from what we in the present think the text is interested in and what the text views as important, which tends to say more about us in the present than about the text itself. We want the text, we want the Bible to be moral. We want it to be ethical. One of the things that I do in my classes right away is present students with stories from the Bible that raise a lot of eyebrows and don't tend to be taught in Sunday school or Hebrew day school. And again, that's my As a famous scholar once told me, got a lot of chutzpah, but I find that really fascinating and interesting, and I want to show students those stories, such as Judges 19 to 21 and the rape of the concubine, and who is cut up into 12 different pieces and sent to the various tribes of Israel, which launches a war between Israel and the tribe of Benjamin. Not a story that's well known, but a fascinating story. And morality and ethics are at question in that story, but the way that we expect this story or the text to have this moral or ethical vision, it might be a little different than we would want it to be.
I wonder if we, as particularly as Americans in the 21st century, look upon myth as something that other civilizations deal with and have. You've made the statement that most of us, when we hear the word mythology, mm-hmm. think of ancient Greeks.
Yes.
And if we consider that in our own society, we really don't have myths.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you are defining myth as ancient Greek mythology, then no, we don't have myths in our exactly. society. But if we're defining myth as stories that are important to our society and are told in such a way that so that all of us can share in that importance, then there are a lot of myths within our society. And I would tend to lean on the latter, that myth, this is also why I find myth and the study of myth so interesting, is that it's very complicated, and it's also had a very bad history. That absolutely, we tend to define other people's stories as myth, not our own stories. And when we, so in that way, myth becomes a political weapon that you can define, you can subjugate people with, define them as other. That ours are scripture, theirs are myth. And so the language is loaded in that way.
Even my religion, their superstition.
Exactly. That getting back to language, that these words can do a lot of work. And by doing a lot of work, they can do a lot of damage as well. So there's always value judgments at play whenever we're using the word myth.
Would you call the story of Paul Bunyan an American myth?
That could be an American myth.
Santa Claus?
Santa Claus is absolutely a very important American myth. I think, especially in our present day, a lot of myths hew less to the, say, the supernatural, and maybe more to the political or the historical, as they relate to stories that tell us who we are, as a society, or who we are as individuals, who we are as Americans. Nationalism, myth, and religion all share this really interesting overlap. That there are some very religioid aspects of nationalism and national identity.
We think of how we think we remember George Washington,
exactly.
Abraham Lincoln, the great figures in our history, mm-hmm. and a lot of that turns out to be Napoleon, mm-hmm. you know, mythologized
yeah.
after all these years. Mm-hmm. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse, time for us to take another break. I'll be back with Dr. Dustin Nash in just a moment.
Not only is becoming a WDIY member a great way to support the programs you love, it has its benefits. WDIY members have access to our weekly member ticket giveaway emails. Discover great concerts, theater performances, film screenings, and more, all while supporting the many choices and real voices on WDIY. Make your gift today at 610-694-8100, extension 7, or wdiy.org. Thank you.
Dustin, you have been a professor at Muhlenberg College now for 5 years,
mm-hmm.
and your family moved. You were in Ithaca?
Yeah, Ithaca, New York.
As you were doing your graduate study, finishing up there, and then you came to the Lehigh Valley.
Mm-hmm.
You have two children.
Yes.
And who are they? What are their ages?
So Elias is actually, if this is Thanksgiving Day, he is 8 years old today. Happy birthday.
Oh, it's his birthday.
It's his birthday.
Ooh.
Well, it's his birthday on the 24th. So, but he was born on Thanksgiving Day, so we always...
All right, any Thanksgiving Day is his birthday.
He's a turkey baby. That's why.
That's fun.
And Ruby is 5.
All right, so you have there with your elementary school children.
Mm-hmm.
And your wife...
My wife, Lorena, she teaches, or doesn't teach, she's in the registrar's department at Muhlenberg College. We met, actually, as graduate students at Harvard Divinity School. So she was studying South Asian religions, actually, at the time, and I was studying Hebrew Bible and everything that you mentioned earlier. But most of my friends were studying South Asian religions. It just happened to be the group of people that I had met in orientation. We actually, both of us, met on orientation day. And I always joke that I hung out with the people studying South Asian religions and Hinduism because they were more fun than the Bible people.
And I'm just guessing, taking a wild guess here, that you you and your wife were married in the rare books room of the library at Hartford.
We were not. my wife's from Western Colorado, and so we were married in Craig, Colorado, by a friend of hers who was her chaplain and when she was an undergraduate. So
that's a town I haven't heard of.
It's not a big town. Yeah. It's a smaller town in the western slope of the Rockies. And I grew up in Iowa, so I go to Colorado where I visit where she grew up, and to this day I think it's just fabulous. There's topography, and I'm not used to that.
Yes, exactly. No, you're from the flatlands.
Yeah.
Dustin, I'd like you to tell our listeners, when you walked into the first classroom at Muhlenberg College, mm-hmm. the very first question that a student put to you.
Yes, I walked in and began introducing the class, and before I had even finished speaking, a student raised their hand, and so I called on them, and without any other warning, just asked me, "How old are you?"
That's a question I've never heard of a professor. And what was the reason for that?
Because I look young.
You do indeed.
Yeah.
So Dr. Nash visited two museums in Kentucky and presented the findings from there. I believe it was from there, Dustin, at the Rencontre Assyriologique Internationale, a conference on Assyriology. There's a $10 word that we don't use very much. and Near Eastern Archaeology, and that was at Austria's University of Innsbruck.
Yes.
There's a beautiful part of the world.
Yes, it was beautiful. It's my first time to
Austria.
It was wonderful.
What an experience for you. You were one of 10 speakers at the workshop, Misuse of Sources, Ancient and Modern.
Mm-hmm.
What is misuse of sources?
In this case, they were interested in looking at the ways that both ancient scribes and modern, we should say modern scribes, use ancient sources, so that even in the ancient world, we can see scribes recontextualizing stories, so taking them out of their original context to use them in new cases. I don't think anybody at the conference or within that particular workshop passed judgment on whether or not these groups were misusing such sources, but that there was this very active utilization of them for their own means, and that just as that happens today, we're living in a world where today where information or particular facts can be read and used in widely different contexts depending on how they're presented and where you emphasize and what you emphasize. That's not necessarily new. That's something that's been going on since the dawn of writing, as it were.
Right. I think some of that, what do you think about this, that ancient scribes, and we tend to think of scribes as simply copying whatever is dictated to them or that they're reading.
Yeah.
Was it more likely in Middle Ages and even before that, that scribes would be reading something that's put down it next to their tablet, or would they be listening to somebody dictate?
It depends on the context. So scribal practices changed and were different within different cultures. But when it comes to the ancient Near East, and here I'm talking about the world of what is presently Israel and Syria and Iraq and even Egypt, in a particular way, that in that world where scribes were producing texts, there were contexts in which they were being recited. But scribes were also in the process of memorizing the text, that memorization was an important element. It was actually perhaps even the primary goal of what it was that the scribes were doing. being a scribe was less being a copying machine and more a social role, that you had a function to be the transmitter of the cultural wisdom of that society. So anybody that's ever had to study for a test will know that writing something out, taking notes, making flashcards will help you remember it better. So a lot of what we have as writing, especially from, say, ancient Mesopotamia, is likely the byproduct of students either in the process of memorization or demonstrating memorization of texts. So the goal, the location where these texts were meant to reside is less on the clay tablet and more within the minds of the scribes themselves. There's a great great book by a very important, a wonderful scholar by the name of Carr, who has a book called Written on the Tablet of the Heart. So that it was the process of memorization to become the transmitter and, say, guardian of that tradition. This was the real goal, not so much the thing.
And are you saying that the scribe's mentality was likely not so much we want to pass on what we have experienced here to future generations in the 21st century, but almost a test to show the superiors that they're able to do the work of a scribe?
Yes, exactly.
Wow.
There were libraries in the ancient world, so those kinds of texts, there were cases where people were collecting texts in order to preserve them and have them available to them. But a lot of writing that we have is becoming more and more realized. It's likely done by adolescents and was a product of, or younger, of them learning to become these, learning to inhabit that social role of the scribe. And what this also means is that if, as a scribe, if the goal is not so much that you perfectly reproduce the every symbol on the page, as it were, and more that you become the master of the tradition itself. And when you become the master of the tradition yourself, you are empowered to change it over time if it needs to be changed.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times I think we figure, let's take a story that we are interested in. I'm thinking particularly the Song of Roland.
Mm-hmm.
So there's one main manuscript for that, but there are bits of others, bits of the story in other places. And what we tend to want to learn now is, what is the real story?
Mm-hmm.
It becomes very complicated.
Yes, and what's, I'd say, just within maybe the past 20 years, there's been a growing recognition that there really isn't the story in a lot of these cases. There's just worlds of traditions, and that so for a long time it was also the interest of textual criticism and biblical studies to get back to the Ur text, the original text. How do we get back to the original text? And texts are written, and there are manuscript families, and all of that is true. But when it comes to even going deeper than that on these stories, there simply may not be an original story. It's more of a conglomeration of myriad variants, and that were all produced in particular contexts with particular interests and with maybe tiny changes, and may in other cases exactly the same, but in other cases very different. And one isn't necessarily more original or more true than another one.
Dr. Dustin Nash is my guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse. Let's talk a little bit, Dustin, about the study, the academic study of the Bible versus what we might get at church or at synagogue, of talking about the Bible. How does that, I suppose as an academic person, this is more fascinating to you, to compare religions, to compare how people see the texts and so on.
Yeah. It's what it is a constant challenge that's somewhat unique to teaching about religion within a secular academic context, that that I don't imagine there isn't the same kind of issue when you're in the chemistry classroom or even say a history classroom, though there's lots of bias that can come into play in the study of history. But when we start touching on people's personal identities and particular personal relationships with texts that have been important to them, have been told that they're important to them, have learned about in particular contexts, in particular religious devotional contexts, and then to come into my classroom and sometimes what I say about the texts or about history doesn't correlate with what people have learned in the past. This is a recurring perennial issue that I say that I'm constantly trying to get better at how I deal with in the classroom. And I think everyone who teaches religion is constantly trying to get better at. Trying to make space that what we do in my classrooms isn't the approach to the study of religion. It's an approach, one that's rooted in the same kind of assumptions about authority and where authority rests that we would have in other classes on a college campus. So in that history classroom or in that chemistry classroom, where we put authority within a devotional context is going to be different, and therefore we're going to ask different questions. We're going to reach different conclusions. It doesn't make one, at least where I am presently at this moment, because I change my mind about all of these things constantly. But at the present moment, how I'm thinking about it is that those questions that in those other contexts might be irrelevant, and it's not that one is more correct or more true than the other one.
Since you mentioned more correct, more true, let's go to your experience in Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
And here is something that was written up for a publication of Muhlenberg College. In the age of fake news and alternative facts, Nash's research encourages thinking about how interpretation plays a role in the creation of knowledge. And so they are quoting you, and you tell me if this is a correct mm-hmm. quote. What I tell my students frequently is that facts don't have inherent meaning, but they are given meaning in particular context. There's mm-hmm. our word context
yes.
again. You love it. What this really shows is interpretation allows for a great deal of data or facts to be aligned with a pre-existing ideology.
Yes.
So are we saying that there's no such thing as the truth or a fact that...
I don't go that far. I say that facts exist, but the mere existence of facts... humans aren't fact-based creatures.
Mm-hmm.
So for us to understand facts, it's one thing, say, to know about the background radiation observed in the universe and the observation of galaxies moving away and all of this. All of those are observable things with experimental evidence that require interpretation. It's up to us how valid we regard that interpretation, but they require interpretation, and it might be a deeply, and I would argue, a very deeply compelling argument about the Big Bang and rapid expansion of the cosmos, and this is an origin of the origin of our universe. But all of that is just data, and there's all kinds of research to show how humans, or we as people, can bring these things in what we choose to look at and what we don't look at, and how we make conscious and unconscious choices about what we expose ourselves to, and how just knowing more facts doesn't necessarily lead to everybody agreeing on a conclusion. This is something that I've seen a lot because of my work on the Creation Museum and the Ark Encounter in Kentucky, because these are young Earth creationist facilities. That is, they argue, they deny the validity of evolution, and they argue that the Bible is an inerrant historical source on the origin of the cosmos, and that the world is a little less than 6,000 years old, and that science backs up that argument. So from something that a lot of people ask me about is how can they deny science? They don't deny science at all. They argue that mainstream scientific conclusions are bad science, and that good science correlates with their argument. And they have a variety of pieces of evidence that they are more than happy to show you to explain why they view their position as being valid. So there's all kinds of things that they're just knowing, say, more of the data regarding cosmology isn't going to suddenly change all the people that work at the Creation Museum's minds. Nor do I think anybody who is deeply convinced by the argument of the Big Bang and evolution can go to the Creation Museum or the Ark Encounter and have their mind changed about it.
Interesting, yes. Well, believe it or not, Dustin, this is all the time we have for Lehigh Valley Discourse for this Thanksgiving. And once again, from all of us at WDIY, we wish you a very happy Thanksgiving time with family and or friends. Dustin, thanks so much for coming by.
Well, thank you for having me.
Loved it. I'm John Pierce, your host here on Lehigh Valley Discourse, WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org. Our engineer, Neil Heaver, thanks so much, Neil. And until we meet again, remember to be gentle with your neighbor.